welcome to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. You can hear us live at accesssacramento.org, or you can listen to this program and past programs at greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com. Today's program includes Scott Horton interviews Gareth Porter. Gareth Porter is an independent historian and journalist for IPS News. He discusses the acceptance of the false Iraqi war narrative, and he explains how the U.S. and Iran are essentially partners in meddling in Iraqi politics. And then after that, Riz Khan of Al Jazeera English questions the food distribution system. He asks, with more than 1 billion people around the world considered overweight, why are there so many others still starving and struggling to fill their place? Hello and welcome to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. You can hear us live at accesssacramento.org, or you can listen to this program and past programs at greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com. Today's program includes Riz Khan of Al Jazeera English questions the food distribution system. He asks, with more than 1 billion people around the world considered overweight, why are there so many others still starving and struggling to fill their place?
Hello and welcome. Why do nearly a billion people around the world lack enough to eat, while an even larger number are overweight? Poorly designed government policies and corporate control of the world's food system could be the culprits. Rising food prices and economic hardship are making it more difficult for the global poor to feed themselves. And as multinational corporations flood the markets with mass-produced foods around the world, struggling farmers are being pushed out of business, leaving consumers with even fewer options. Many populations, attracted by convenience and cheaper price tags, are transitioning from locally grown food to often less nutritious store-bought ones, leading to a rising rate in obesity. On today's show, we ask, what can be done to make the global food system more equitable? Remember, you can join our conversation with your questions and comments. You can send us an SMS or an email, and we also take your phone calls on the show. Here with me to discuss the issues is Raj Patel, a fellow at the Institute for Food and Development Policy, also known as Food First, a California-based think tank that studies the injustices that cause hunger. Mr. Patel is also the author of Stuffed and Starved, The Hidden Battle for the World Food System. Raj, welcome to the show.
It's good to be here, Riz.
Good to have you with us. I want to start by asking, what is the problem we're looking at exactly? Is it that there are a growing number of hungry people around the world, or is it that the food available to them is less nutritious?
Well, it's a bit of both. If you look at the trends, we're seeing increasing numbers of people who are in who are undernourished and malnourished. That said, of course, last year we had over a billion people who were going hungry. This year, the Food and Agriculture Organization at the United Nations estimates that it's about 925 million. So we've seen a decrease over the past year of about 100 million people, but the trend is ever upward. And that suggests that one of the problems that we are talking about is poverty and a growing number of people who are unable to afford to be able to feed themselves. At the same time, what we're also seeing is something called the nutrition transition. As more and more people around the world shift from a diet that is about locally produced, as you say, fresh fruits and vegetables, towards food that is more industrially produced, food that is higher in salt and fat and sugar. And so the sort of simultaneity of both an increasing number of poor people and this nutrition transition is leading to the sort of paradoxical situation where we are seeing higher numbers of people going hungry and higher levels of diabetes and of heart disease and of diseases associated with obesity and overweight.
Well, let's go over that, Raj. You said 925 million people. The UN says that that's the number that don't have enough food. That's more than the populations of the US, Canada, and the EU combined. What's bizarre, though, is that the overweight number of people overweight is even higher, much higher. The WHO, the World Health Organization, says that by 2015, the number of overweight will go up by 1.6 billion to 2.3 billion adults, with the number of them that are clinically obese more than doubling. That's going to be from 300 million to 700 million people considered clinically obese. Now, it might appear paradoxical, but what signs are there that many of today's hungry will be tomorrow's overweight? I mean, is it possible for the starving to become obese?
It is, and in fact, if you look at the country that has the highest number of people who have type 2 diabetes, that country is India. And research in India is prompting a lot of rethinking in the scientific community about how overweight happens. And what seems to be the case is that when people grow up in conditions of poverty, and particularly in utero and in the first 2 years of life, so during pregnancy and in the first 2 years of life, if mothers and then their children are on very poor diets, then those children grow up very ill-equipped. Their bodies are very ill-equipped to deal with the Western diet. They're very ill-equipped to deal with, as I say, the sort of onslaught of salt and fat and sugar to which we are increasingly exposing our children. Now, what that means is that in the next generation, children who are born hungry end up being more predisposed to being diabetic, and therefore predisposed to being overweight and, in some cases, obese. And if you want to see how this works, of course, you know, the most obese country on earth is the United States. But according to some studies, the second most obese country on the in the world is a developing country. It's Mexico. And that also points to a fact that that there's a biological component for sure, but there's also a marketing component as well. And if you look, for example, in Mexico, the closer you get to the United States border in Mexico, the more likely Mexican teenagers are to be overweight. And that has a lot to do with income, but a lot to do with marketing and food as well.
That's fascinating. You know, I've got an email that came in from Nigeria, if I can put this to you, from Ibrahim Mohamed Ogi, who wrote in saying, As malnourished as Africa is, it is still a huge exporter of food to the developed countries. This bad habit advances hunger, pollution, and health hazards. And I wonder, to what degree does that seem oxymoronic to people, the fact that, you know, you have a country that is exporting food when there's still starvation, or countries that are exporting food while there's still starvation within their boundaries?
Well, of course, I mean, this points to the bigger picture. I think Ibrahim is right to observe that there's an irony here, that there are countries where there are people going hungry, and at the same time, food is being exported worldwide. Now, of course, it's not just Africa that has this, and it's important to bear in mind that, for example, here in the United States, there are, according to the U.S. government last year, over 50 million Americans who are in a situation of food insecurity. They at some point during the year, don't know where their next meal is coming from. And the United States, of course, is one of the world's largest exporters of food. It's one of the world's richest countries. And yet there is hunger right here in the United States as well. It's a global phenomenon. And it suggests that there's something wrong, not just with our food production system, but also with the way that we distribute food and the way that the economics of food works. So certainly in Africa, that there is trade in food, but there's no guarantee offered by countries and by governments to ensure that the hungriest get fed.
Now, an email that came in from Portugal, I could put to you, from Virginia, says, is capitalism and the, quote, civilized world the culprit of everything from famine to worldwide misery? Surely devastating corruption and dishonest, incompetent political leadership in many developing countries must be held accountable too. Valid point, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And I think, you know, if we look at the history of how hunger happens, of course, we can. There's more than enough blame to go around. That said, of course, it's important to ask why it is that, for example, many countries in Africa were able to feed their populations, but now are unable to. Or even, let's take the poorest country here in the Western Hemisphere. Let's talk about Haiti. Haiti, at the beginning of the 1980s, was able to feed its own population. It grew the majority of the rice that was eaten in Haiti. But because of trade liberalization policies pushed by the United States, Haiti became dependent on U.S. rice imports. And this problem isn't one that's been observed by people like me. I mean, even Bill Clinton apologized earlier on this year for treating food as a commodity. I mean, Bill Clinton said, I'm paraphrasing it here, but very likely, that we shouldn't be treating food just like another commodity, we shouldn't treat food like television sets. If countries are going to develop, they need to be able to feed themselves. So I certainly think that incompetence and corruption plays a part, and of course sometimes that incompetence and that corruption happens in the United States and is exported around the world. But I certainly think that leaders in developing countries have their fair share of blame to have as well.
So Raj, if we have a system that's currently based on free trade and profit maximization, is the stage being set for a potentially catastrophic food crisis?
Well, I mean, in a sense, of course, we're already living through that catastrophic food crisis. As you'll remember, many of viewers will remember, in 2008, there was a very big food price crisis. That's why we saw over 1 billion people going hungry in 2008. And for many of those people, that crisis is still happening. I mean, 925 million people is still a lot of people going hungry. And for the poorest people on earth, the crisis of 2008 really isn't over. What has happened is, of course, you know, the recession has cooled off some of the the contributing factors to that, but particularly the price of oil. But as the economy recovers insofar as it does, the price of oil will go up and more people will find themselves in that situation. So when we think about a hunger crisis, we need to be thinking about it as a sort of protracted emergency in which, as I say, nearly a billion people today are engaged.
Examining some of the politics, if I could put another email to you. This came in from a viewer by the name of Arthur Lahini Pierre, who says, withholding food gives a country the power to bargain, occupy, bribe and conquer. The hunt for food drives humans back to primitive behaviors. To what degree does that actually happen, that food is you know, food commodities are withheld as a way of political leverage?
Well, again, one doesn't need to sort of imagine shady backroom deals and conspiracy theories here. In the United States, for instance, one of the Secretaries of Agriculture, Earl Butz, who was a Secretary of Agriculture in the 1970s, I believe, said that food is a weapon in the U.S. arsenal. And it's easy to see that the use of food and food aid is closely tied to politics. And this isn't, again, a sort of shady conspiracy. This is an open fact that's been stated by, for example, the United States Agency for International Development. So absolutely, the ability to turn food on and to make food aid available or to withhold it is part of a broader series of diplomatic instruments that countries use in their dealings with one another. And that's a sort of fact of international life.
Now, before we take a break, let's get a call from Saudi Arabia. Fawzan has a question. Go ahead.
Yeah, please.
Hi, go ahead, please.
Yeah, nice speaking to you.
Yeah, please, go through.
Okay, just now he mentioned that commodity, the word commodity. Food, 20 years back, was never a commodity. Okay? And all this means in this, these people, those people who trade in food, they are just doing it for their interests. So for the people who grow the food, they go hungry, and these people buy that in advance at meager and penny distinct cost. And then the so-called hedging, the so-called trading, so-called it's now easier for richer people, richer countries to get richer, and the poorer people to get poorer.
Okay,
Fawzan.
Fawzan, I'm going to put that to our guest Raj Patel in just a moment. We're going to take a short break now, though, but we'll continue with an answer to that question when we come back. Welcome back. We're talking about the injustices of the global food market and what can be done about it. Joining us from San Francisco is Raj Patel, the author of Stuffed and Starved, The Hidden Battle for the World Food System. And Raj, on that issue, that question from Fawzan in Saudi Arabia earlier on, he was talking about the gap between the have and have-nots when it comes to food. But let me ask you, who controls what we eat? Is it the multinational corporations, the big ones like Cargill and Monsanto, or is it even possibly the sellers of food, the supermarkets, the chains that we go to when we get food?
Well, it's a mixture. Of course, I mean, the advertising plays a very big role in deciding what it is that we want. And there's a lot of advertising, for example, of fast food to children. Globally, just to give you a sense, for every dollar that's spent promoting food that's healthy for kids, about $500 is spent promoting stuff that's bad for them. And so that marketing comes not only from the fast food corporations, but also from the consumer goods corporations. And supermarkets have a role to play here, but so do the international grain traders. And I think that there's plenty of blame to go around here. In fact, it's not just the multinational corporations that are in the business of deciding how it is that we eat, but governments do too. I mean, in the United States, we have comprehensive subsidies for the corn industry, for example. And the wide availability of corn and things like high fructose corn syrup and the government subsidies that are available to make that widely available is also responsible for the fact that you can find high fructose corn syrup in the United States in pretty much everything. So it is a mixture not only of the individual corporations that are responsible for marketing particular brands of food, but also from the companies that are responsible for trading it, the supermarkets that are responsible for selling it, and the governments that are responsible for pushing us and allowing a food system that is increasingly unsustainable.
All right, Tom is on the line from Qatar. Tom, go ahead.
Hello, it's very interesting listening to yourself and Raj. I had an experience earlier in my life. 30 years ago, I worked as a volunteer in Kenya. At that time, Daniel Arap Moi the Kenyatta had just died. Daniel Arap Moi came in. He needed some support from America, from other sources. And at that time, the east coast of Africa was the garden of the east coast of Africa. Subsistence crops were growing, and the the situation was that it was feeding Africa. He allied himself to the Americans. He got the Del Monte man in. The Del Monte people come in, con the farmers to grow pineapples. This takes 2-3 years. Over this period of 2-3 years, they raised the prices of the pineapples. Right. Got the farmers completely frenzied about growing pineapples. And then, as soon as they got them set up with this, they plunged the price of pineapples, bankrupted the farmers, then stole the land off them.
Okay.
And by this time, we're in a situation where all the food that had been grown to feed the people in Kenya, that Kenyatta, who had been a benign leader of the people...
Yeah. Well, Tom, the reason I'm interrupting you is because we're a bit short on time. I'm going to put this to Raj, the dynamics that take place here, and it ties into actually an SMS we just received from another viewer. Jess E. wrote in via SMS saying, why isn't nutrition and curbing hunger as important as trade agreements and agricultural policies and subsidies? And this ties in also to the kind of manipulations that Tom says he saw while living in Kenya.
Well, I mean, of course, if you look to international law, there is such a thing as the right to food. And sadly, that right has rather been trampled on by the interests of large corporations, of powerful governments. And, I mean, what we're seeing around the world, I mean, one doesn't want to sort of paint doom and gloom, though what we're seeing at the same time as we need to be sort of very clear-sighted about the kinds of things that Tom did see, is a movement that's trying to push back against these trade liberalization agreements. I mean, the liberalization agreements have caused a great deal of damage and exposed farmers around the world and consumers around the world to a great deal of fluctuation and variability in prices. But we are seeing movements now, in particular after the food crisis in 2008, of governments and organizations within countries pushing back and demanding the restitution of the barriers that were knocked down under these trade agreements and through things like the World Trade Organization's agreement on agriculture. But sadly, I mean, I think it's important to recognize that the profit motive and, you know, its use by corporations is really driving a food agenda that does trump the right to food.
Now, Raj, you write about the need for or the issue of food sovereignty, you know, people reclaiming their right to choose what they want to eat. And how can, you know, individuals make that kind of choice when really, as we've just been discussing, it's so much out of their hands?
Well, I think, Riz, the issue is that, I mean, as individuals, we're sort of atomized and powerless, and the only thing that we can do is sort of shop slightly smarter. And I think that's the right thing to do. I mean, you know, fair trade is a good thing to do, because the opposite of unfair trade or unsustainable trade or unconscionable trade, certainly no one wants to do. But as individuals, it's very hard. What we're seeing, though, is that at a more collective level, particularly at the level of municipalities and of provinces, there is a movement to have this idea of food sovereignty, of people taking back control of the food system and ensuring that everyone in their city, for example, gets fed. There are examples of this around the world. They're flourishing in North America. There are over 200 what are called food policy councils. These are places where the private sector plus, you know, government plus civic organizations get together and figure out how it is that hunger will be brought to zero in these areas. But what characterizes these examples is that you know, the multinationals are not at the table, and the kinds of rules of trade that prevail internationally are suspended. And decisions are made, for example, to purchase locally, to make sure that wages are fair, that environmental standards are adhered to. And that's a very different kind of way of thinking about the food system than applies at the international level.
Another caller here on the line from the USA, from Virginia. Arch is on the line. Go ahead, Arch.
Thanks for taking my call, Riz.
Pleasure.
My question relates to policy in the United States. How can we have any change in the legal system when those who work for multinational corporations, such as Monsanto, who work for those sort of companies, eventually work on for the government, such as the FDA? How can we have any change when those who are promoting no change in the system eventually work for government agencies?
The power of lobbying, effectively, and the power of the insiders in the system.
Well, I think that's exactly right. If we sort of sit back and wait for the federal government to bring change, we'll be waiting a very long time. There is a revolving door between agribusiness and the Food and Drug Administration, particularly the United States Department of Agriculture. But that suggests where the change needs to come from. It needs to come driven by citizens and by citizens' organizations. That's the only way that change has ever happened in the United States or any other country, come to think of it. And so what's happening in the United States is that there is a movement of community organizations fighting for this idea of food sovereignty. And there is change coming from below, and that's the way democracy works. Democracy never trickles down, it always bubbles up.
Now, the issue we face, though, is in the developing world, people don't have those kind of choices, and the sort of the issue of food sovereignty is a far more difficult aspect, concept to grasp. So we have food riots taking place, and I would, you know, perceive there'd be the chance of more of that happening. And of course, farmers are being driven out of business, small enterprises being driven out of business, many of them committing suicide.
Well, you're right, of course, but the idea of food sovereignty did in fact start in the Global South precisely because farmers and citizens wanted more power than they had been previously given within the food system. But you're exactly right, Riz, that there are these food rebellions. It's been underreported this year, but there have been food protests in India, in Egypt, in Serbia, in Mozambique, and even in China, protests that are about living standards and also about the increasingly unaffordable price of food. And again, what we're seeing in a number of these countries is citizens demanding change from their government. When you see food protests on TV, usually you'll just see the burning tire in the road when the camera crews arrive too late to capture the real moment of people demanding not only food, but change from their government. And I think that that's the sort of common denominator, that if we're going to see change in the United States or indeed in the Global South, the models of change that we're seeing and the kind of protests that we're seeing are in fact demands for food sovereignty. They're demands for governments finally to pay attention not to USAID or to the demands of multinationals, but the demands of the citizens and particularly the poorer citizens.
Now, can that, just a thought with a minute to go, Raj, can that movement, the grassroots movement, have any impact on the power of the juggernaut of the food trading system and the lobbying that we've discussed?
Well, I think, in short, we need pessimism of the intellect and optimism of the will. I mean, we shouldn't be misty-eyed about the trouble and the trouble we're in and the challenges ahead. But I am sanguine that there are groups like La Via Campesina, that there are movements for food sovereignty happening around the world. And that does give me some hope that we are seeing a transition away from a world where we're seeing a billion people hungry and a billion people starving towards a much more sustainable food system.
And you do see it happening in a realistic future, or is it a long term? Just a quick thought.
It needs to happen right now, and it is happening right now, but of course in the long term we'll need much more systemic change, and I think we're moving in that direction.
All right, Raj Patel, thank you very much for that, and thanks for discussing the issue with us, taking our questions.
Thank you, Riz.
We'll meet again. Don't know when, don't know when, but I know we'll some sunny day. Keep smiling through, just like you always do, till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away. So will you please say hello to the folks that I know. Tell them I won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as you saw me go, I was singing this song. We'll meet again. Don't know when, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day.
We'll meet again. Don't know when, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Keep smiling through, just like you. Oh.
That's all, folks.